First, let me thank the committee for giving me a beautiful, beautiful weekend. Up to this moment, it's been perfect. I'm a little nervous when I get up in front of a group, so sort of bear with me. My name's Millie Copeland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a very grateful alcoholic. I'm grateful to every alcoholic who ever walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, whether they're drunk or sober. That's not important, because you see, each one has taught me something. Many have taught me how to live, and many have taught me how not to live, and for this I'm grateful. Many of you in this room have heard me over and over again, and I'm sorry you have to hear me again. But I go strictly by the big book. I'm going to try to tell you what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. I was born and raised in Virginia. If there are any Virginians in this room, I'm sorry, but I have to tell it like it is. All Virginians are basically snobs. They're born that way. They can't help it. And this Virginia pride darn near killed me. I would love to be able to stand up here and tell you I was a lady when I drank. And I sipped a little sherry, passed out very gracefully in my own living room. But you see, when I came in AA, the first thing the boys taught me, there weren't many women around when I came in, but the boys taught me that I had to be honest if I wanted to stay sober. So I couldn't honestly tell you I was that type of drunk. I was a two-fisted, fighting Irish drunk. Loved a good argument and a fight when necessary. And got into many of them. I'm from a family of 12 children. You know, I hear all this stuff going around here and I get real tickled, but I'm from a family of 12 children who had the same parents, same education, same everything, and I was the only drunk in the family. This is why I'm convinced it is a disease. I had a lot of problem. I'm not blaming my drinking on anyone, but I'm telling you, what I'm going to tell you is how I reacted to situations in my life. I love my father too much, and I know this. I wanted to be exactly like my dad. And every summer, he used to take me out on the tug. My father was in the tugboat business. And he'd take me on the tug. And by the time I was 7 or 8 years old, I could read a compass and steer that tug as well as he could down the harbor. In fact, I learned to smoke. When he'd go down in the engine room in the galley, I'd pick up his pipe and puff on it and pretend I was my father. And this is the way I learned to smoke. At 8 years old. I wanted to be something special to this man. Now I look back, I mean, how could I be number one when he had 11 others, you know? But this was my problem. I was always trying to prove myself to my dad. I can't stand rejection today. If I walk up to you and start to put my arm around you and you back up, you can bet your life, Millie, and never do it again. Rejection bothers me very much. And my father lived and died, and I never kissed him. He didn't approve of this. He was a Southern gentleman, and he just did not approve of his girl sitting on his lap. He was narrow-minded. That's what he was. But I grew up with this. And when I was 18 years old, and the woman in this room doesn't know what I'm talking about, I met my Isaac. And I was in love for the first time in my life. And we courted for some 6 months, and my dad was out at sea. And when he returned, he broke us up, and he would not let me see Isaac. Not only was he from the wrong side of the track, but he was a Jew. Now, a Catholic didn't mess with a Jew some 50 years ago in Norfolk anyhow. so he broke us up. But I want to go back a little ways. You see, I had problems with drinking right from the very beginning. I never knew anything about social drinking. If you had a bottle, I could be mighty sociable, but that's all I knew about sociable drinking. Because my first drink, I was 15 years old, and I was babysitting for a family. It was a Christmas, and when they returned, they brought some friends with them. I'm going to date myself now. And Mr. Jack was in the kitchen mixing alcohol and grapefruit juice. And I was like any teenager, I was most interested in what he was doing. And he asked me, he said, "Millie, would you like to have one?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd never seen any liquor in my life." Mother kept a little sherry at home when the priests would come. I don't know how you live, but in our part of the country, we had a parlor, a sitting room. We didn't have a family, a sitting room and a dining room. The parlor was only used when the priest came or a guest came to the house. And Mother would serve sherry wine. But I had never seen anybody drunk, or I knew nothing about it. And so I said, "Yes, I want to try it." So I took my first one. I've never liked the word fat. I was a short, stubby little girl. I had acne, and I was very sensitive. And that first drink hit my tummy, and I was 5'6" immediately, or 5'8" immediately. My skin cleared up. I was the sexiest thing in the world to myself. The second one I asked for. The third one I stole. And I went home drunk for the first time in my life. Now, needless to tell you, that was the end of my babysitting for that family. And from that day until this, I could almost end my story there. Every time that I picked up a drink, I got drunk. I liked what it did to me. I liked the taste of it. I liked everything about liquor. And as I said, I met Isaac, and my father broke us up. And I was heartbroken like any 18-year-old girl. And I'd been ill, and some friends stopped by to see me. And in the group was a serviceman, a Navy man. Now, that was something else that I was taught from age one. Don't you ever associate with a sailor. If I ever catch you with a sailor, blah, blah, blah. So I was scared of sailors. He was not in uniform, and I didn't realize he was in the service. But anyhow, some 3 weeks later, he walked in. I was working in a drugstore and going to school, and he walked in the drugstore, and he knew me. I didn't recognize him. He introduced himself. And he just bought a new car, and he asked if I'd... There was a place in Portsmouth that was called the 30th Division Club. And all the girls used to whisper about this place. I'd never seen it, and I was curious. And he asked if I would like to go to the 30th Division Club, and I said, "Oh, yeah." He had a bottle of gin. And we went out to look at the car, and I decided to go to the 30th Division, and we started nipping on the bottle of gin. Now, to get to Portsmouth from Norfolk was about 20 minutes, I guess. We drank that fifth before we got to Portsmouth. And he began to shoot me the line that all older men shoot young ladies, you know. "I fell in love with you the first time I saw you," and blah, blah, blah. "Let's get married." I thought, well, now I'll marry this joker, and this will get even with Isaac, the captain, and everybody else. Now, if there are any Alanines in the room, and your spouse tells you they don't remember, you believe them. Because I cannot remember anything that happened that night, other than we could not be married in Virginia. You see, you had to wait 3 days in Virginia to get married. And I don't know of any active drunk's going to wait 3 days for anything. So we went down North Carolina, South Mills. And when we got there, it was a lock on the door was broken, couldn't lock the car. And I didn't want to lose the bottle. And I didn't want to hide it. I was afraid I couldn't find it when I came out. Now, this is alcoholic thinking as far as I'm concerned. I sat it right in the middle of the sidewalk so I'd see it as I came out. I remember that. And that's all I remember. Now, I don't tell you these things to entertain you. I just pray with all my heart there might be one woman in this room that I might be able to reach, and she wouldn't have to go as far as Millie Copeland had to go. The next thing I remembered, I awakened to this horrible voice singing Amapola. And I thought, my God, I've spent the night. My father's going to kill me. And I opened one eye, and I was so grateful. At least I recognized him. And he came over, and he said, good morning, Ms. Martin. Would you like to have a drink? Not only did I like to have one, I needed one that morning. And I went on my first drunk. I cannot truthfully tell you how long it lasted, 3 weeks, a month. But I reached the point, I don't know if you've ever reached this point in your drinking, where it wouldn't black me out. I had to face reality, and I knew that I was in a terrible situation. Married to a serviceman, the first thing, and then to be drunk, it was a mess. So I called home, and the captain was able to see again. And I told my mother, now I love my mother dearly, but my mother was a typical Southern lady, stayed dressed all the time, and she worried about the neighbors, constantly what the neighbors would say. So she said, you come home and we'll work something out. Well, by the time I got home, she had called my uncle in Washington, D.C. and had my clothes packed and shipped me to Washington, D.C. She didn't want the neighbors to know about this situation. And I had an uncle who was an executive for the government, and he got me a job. When I hit Washington, D.C., that was paradise. If you ever plan to drink again, that's a good place to drink. Because in Norfolk, we did not have open bars. We had beer taverns, but nice girls didn't go in there. So I had never seen a tavern or a cocktail lounge. And when I hit Washington, D.C., they had them on every corner. They had bands. I loved it all. I loved the music and the excitement and the fights, and I loved the whole deal. And you drank in degrees up there. You could drink up on Connecticut Avenue if you wanted to drink like a lady, whatever that is. And then if you wanted to drink sort of medium class, you could drop down around 14th Street. And then when you began to hit the skids, you went down to 9th and G. Now, down at 9th and G, as long as you could sit up in the booth and hold a buck up, they'd serve you. And I hit all three places. The only reason I can find for my surviving this, the good Lord had blessed me with a healthy body. And I could drink a tremendous amount of liquor. Now, I'm going to tell you what my day was. I was working in the old Navy building, and when I'd get up in the morning, down on the corner was a people's drugstore, and I used to go in there first thing in the morning, and I'd get a bromo salts and BC and ammonia and mix it all together. And the druggist told me one day, he said, young lady, one of these mornings we're going to pick you up off that floor, and you can imagine what I told him. I've cleaned my mouth up since then. But then I'd hit the Navy building, and I'm ashamed to tell this even today. I don't know how civil service is today, but I can tell you how it was some 45 years ago. I'd get a paper in my hand and just walk up and down, and nobody ever asked me what I was doing, where I was going. And I took your tax money every month. I left I'd go out at lunch, and I'd have a double. Didn't have all the fancy things I got today, and I was in with this little waitress, and she'd give me raw coffee, and I'd chew that and go back to the office. And I'd leave there at 4:30, and at 5 o'clock, I'd hit the park side, and when I hit that door, you could hear me for four blocks, start the party, Millie's here. And that's the way I lived. It's almost 10 years. Every time I came home, I always looked up my Isaac. I knew where he'd be. And I've tried to well, I've tried to clean it up the best I can. But Isaac Copeland's a sexist man, I've laid my eyes on him. You know, he was real smart. It's popular today, it wasn't back then, but he had a barrel chest. He wore a 16½ collar. Some of you knew him. You can't imagine what he really looked like when he was young. If you know Joe Penn on Riptide, that's exactly what he looks like. Or he looked like. Curly hair, and he left that shirt open all the way down so that chest would pour. He knew what he was doing. And I'd always go downtown and look for him. He'd either be on the corner in the beer tavern or at the newspaper. And I came home this particular time. See, I only came home when my daddy was not there. Mother would have me home, but I could not go in his home when he was there. Because you see, after I'd been in Washington a short time, I received a letter from my father. And he said, Mildred, he didn't say Millie or dear daughter, he said, Mildred, as far as I'm concerned, you're dead. If you ever return to Norfolk, I will personally see that you're put away. Now, he didn't mean Brian's nice place or chit-chat. He meant the booby hatch, and I knew what he meant. He meant Williamsburg, which is the nut house up in Virginia. And do not correspond with your mother or your sisters. And he signed it, Captain H.P. Tyree, not Daddy, not Father. Now, that should have done something to me. But you see, I used to carry that around in my pocketbook, and I could sit at a bar. And when my money started getting short, I could whip this thing out. Now, I don't know if you'll be as honest as I am, but I was the biggest con artist that ever lived. And I'd whip this thing out and conjure up a couple of tears and read this sad, sad letter. Then all these free drinks would just flow like wine. I wore it plumb out. But one night we were in the bar, and they closed at 12 o'clock, and we could go out to Maryland until 2 and drink. And I was the type of drunk that I accumulated people. You know, I'd go in a bar and I'd pick up 2 or 3 people. And that particular night I had like 20 people. And we all decided to go out to Maryland. And as we were leaving Maryland, we had to have one more drink for the road. And I had a key. Things have changed so much, but I hope you know what I'm talking about. Rock Creek Park was one of the better sections of Washington, D.C. And my uncle had friends there that had gone to Florida for the winter, and they asked me if I'd go by and check on their apartment every now and then. So I had the key to the apartment, and I knew they had a bar, so I asked all my friends in to have a drink. Well, we cleaned out the bar, and it's about 6 o'clock in the morning, we're leaving. We got downstairs, and an argument started. And two boys started fighting, and I got between them. Somebody hit me on the chin and knocked me, and I sat down on the curb. And I saw lights began to come on all over this area. Then I heard the most horrible sound. Now, see, it's different today. They can't just lock a drunk up anymore. But back then, they could lock you up if you were staggering or anything. And so you didn't like sirens. And I heard the siren coming and getting closer by the minute. They don't send one patrol car, they sent 2 patrol cars and a patrol wagon. And of course they locked everybody up but Millie. I told this policeman, I just drew myself up, I said, you don't know who I am. I'm Captain H.P. Tyree's daughter and I'm not getting in a patrol wagon. Well, he put me in. And we fought all the way down to Second Precinct. Now, I thank my God every day of my life that I did not have to go to jail. Because since I've been sober, I've worked with a lot of girls in jail. And it's a different situation with women in jail than it is men, even today. They don't have it made at all. And thank God I didn't have to go through this. And any of the gals in the audience, I don't have to fill that in. They can fill it in and they know what I'm talking about. But I did have to stand the embarrassment of standing for a sergeant. I gave him a fictitious name and a fictitious address. I gave him a black section, and back then whites did not live in black sections, and he knew I wasn't black, but he let me get by with this. That's the only reason I don't have a record, and I'm grateful for this. I went to my room that morning, and my heart bleeds for every woman that's out there today, alone. I know what she's suffering, I know what I suffered. And I went in my room, and the four walls closed in on me. And I thought, what am I going to do? All my friends drink. I can't go home. My father made that clear. I did like many alcoholics. I wanted out of this rat race. So I slashed my wrist. I'm still ashamed of this. And I've had many scars, but they, through age, they've faded, except this one on my arm. And I think God left it there for a purpose. Because never do I look down and wash my dishes or take a bath, and I look down and see the scar, but I don't bow my head and ask God to forgive me. Because, you see, I was going to take the very thing that God had given me, my life, and I was ashamed of this for a long, long time. I still am. And the blood, I was going to cut this one, but the blood was shooting so high, I cut an artery. I went to another Roman friend of mine, and she took me to a doctor. And as he was suturing my arm, he said, "Young lady, I don't know what faith you belong, but you need some help." And I thought to myself, well, that makes sense. You see, when I married this man, you know, they talk about alcoholics not having any willpower. Don't you believe that? When I married this joker that I married, I blamed it on gin. See, I could always rationalize what I was doing. I blamed it on gin. If I had not drank that gin, I would have not gotten in that trouble. And this made sense to me. And believe it or not, I never drank another drop of gin till I married Isaac Copeland. I don't know why, but I never drank another drop. I knew it was a husband in every bottle. I guess that was it. So this time, I was in trouble with liquor. Now, I made an appointment with a priest, and don't misinterpret what I'm saying. I would not live in a community that didn't have churches. But I didn't go to confession. Well, I hadn't taken communion, couldn't. But I made an appointment with him in his office and our study, and I told him as much as I wanted him to hear. And his only answer to me was, come back to the church, get active, and learn to drink sensibly. They knew, they didn't have any answers back there. I can't blame that young man. He didn't know what to do with a drunken woman. Because you see, even today, you may not believe it in larger cities, but in small towns, we're still morally bad. I heard that all my life. I was morally bad. And I felt I was morally bad. And when he told me that, from his study to the front door, see, I was going to do all this stuff when he was talking, but from his study to the front door, I had cleared it all up in my mind. If it had not been for liquor, this wouldn't happen, so I'll cut out liquor. I started drinking beer and wine. Well, I fell off of just as many bar stools and got in just as many fights with a tummy full of beer and wine as I ever did with liquor. It's all poison for me. I came home a short time after this to see my mother. Oh, we were at Virginia Beach, and we came, mother asked us in to dinner, a couple of girlfriends and I. So we came into mother's and had dinner, and as we were leaving, Gracie said, "You know, Millie, I'd like to have a drink." And I said, "Well, the only person I know who can get a drink in Norfolk would be Isaac Copeland." But you see, I'd been home 2 years before this, and I went downtown looking for my Isaac, and he was standing on the corner. He was also an alcoholic, and he was unclean and needed to shave. I had never seen him like this, and I stood across the street and looked at him and thought, well, I've wasted all these years over this man. So I didn't see Isaac for 2 years, but that night we needed a drink. So we went downtown looking for Isaac. And there he stood on the same corner, clean, sober. So I asked him if he knew where we could get a drink, and took us up to the American Legion, and he was not drinking. And when he left the table to speak to a friend, I said to the two girls, you know, this isn't fair. He works for a living, and we've got plenty of money. And I said, we shouldn't let him pay for our drinks. And I told him, he told me years, he said, Millie, I think you still got that resentment. Because I found out later he's sitting there with $400 in his pocket. I wish I'd known it that night. But anyhow, we talked, and he said we made a date. And he came down to the beach on Wednesday, and we walked along the boardwalk, and he said, Millie, you've not found anyone, and I've not found anyone. And he said, why don't we say the heck with the families and get married? Now, he was 39, and I was 28. Now, I don't know why we had to ask the families, but that's how childish we were. Well, this time I did wait the 3 days. Well, in the meantime, I went back to Washington, settled up my affairs, and resigned and whatnot, came back. And Isaac was stoned out of his mind. He was so happy we were going to get married. I always kidded him about it. I was sober the day we got married. He was drunk. But I had bought a lovely dress to be married in. It had short sleeves. And taking the blood test, they missed the vein, and it bled under and left a terrible bruise on my arm. So I had to be married in a suit. And I had on a black suit, white blouse, big, back then you wore a hat if you went to the grocery store. And I had a large picture hat on and a beautiful corsage and white gloves. And we got married. After the ceremony, Isaac said, oh, incidentally, I had bought this gorgeous negligee and nightgown. This was going to be the night of all nights. So Isaac said, you know, we ought to have a drink to celebrate. And I said, yeah, sure should. So we drank. I woke up the next morning in bed with my hat, my gloves, my... That was my husband's honeymoon. But my drinking changed after I married Isaac. As long as I had Isaac in a bottle, I could care less what was going on in the world. And we did a lot of hard, hard drinking. I'll not go into all details. We did a lot of things. He would steal. Now, you know, I hear a lot of you boys talk about, you know, I wish I'd married an alcoholic woman. Let me tell you something. You got a good alanine, you hang on to him. Because you don't know what it's like when they're two in the house together. He'd steal my money. I'd steal his money. He'd steal my liquor. I'd steal his liquor. And we loved each other, really. We tried everything that anybody suggested to keep from getting sick. And I'll share this with you. Somebody told us if we took a laxative the night before that we wouldn't be too sick the next morning. And we're both drunk. And all I had in the house was Epsom salt. And I mixed a big 8-ounce glass of Epsom salts and whiskey for Isaac and mixed one for myself. The next morning, we only had one bathroom. Now that's sick. But you see, my Isaac wanted to do something about his drinking. I didn't. I was happy in my drinking. As long as I had Isaac, I could care less. And he found Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never will forget, and he came home. We'd had a restaurant. I was always trying to make $1 million. Now, I don't know how many of you will be as honest as I am, but I never did think small. And most alcoholics think big. You sit around and listen to him. Everything he ever did was big, nothing small. And I went over and... Now, Isaac never wanted any money. He's the only Jew, if there are any Jews in the room, I'm not making fun, but I'm just saying he's the only Jew I knew that never had any money. And didn't want any. As long as he could make a living, that's all Isaac ever cared about. But Millie did. You see, what I wanted, my dream, was that I could get an Eldorado Cadillac convertible. And a long scarf about 8 foot long that I could, you know, in the breeze, blow in the breeze. And I could go by the captain's house and blow the horn. And... That was my dream, I'm serious. And I was constantly trying to make it. Well, I went over and talked, and that's what I say about alcoholics. People say they're dumb, they're not dumb. We're the smartest people in the world. Anytime you can con a Jew out of enough money going business, you got to be pretty smart. And that's what I did. And I bought typical business for an alcoholic. I bought a beer tavern. Now, I didn't worry about selling beer in that tavern. What I was going to do was put trucks out and sell it by the case, and they would go door to door like the Avine lady, you know. Now, I didn't think about one truck and 10 cases. I was thinking like 10 trucks and 50,000 cases a week. But you see, I think God had a pattern for my life. I'll always believe this. Because after I'd had the business, see, in Virginia, you have to, for the first 8 weeks, they investigate before they issue a license. And they investigated this place, and it was a rough place. It had fights, it served teenagers, everything had happened in my... So they denied me ABC license. And I'll never forget, as long as I live, it was the first day of December of 1947. And this is the way I thought, my God, my father doesn't love me, my mother doesn't love me, Isaac, I'm not too sure, loves me. Now the damn state of Virginia won't let me make a living. So I drank that day. And when Isaac came home, in the meantime, he had found Alcoholics Anonymous. And he went into AA in September. And this was in December, and I repeat it constantly. I know my group gets tired of it, but I make a big deal about that red chip. That's for 3 months. 3 months was the most dangerous time for any alcoholic. It's dangerous to miss your meetings. It's most important that you do make your meetings. But it was about 3 months, and I had been complaining to Isaac about him going to all these dumb meetings and associating with that bunch of bums down there. I didn't know why he couldn't stay in the store and help me. I was trying to make a million for him. And like I say, he didn't want a million. But anyhow, we went out to dinner that night, and when the waitress came over, the first thing I ordered, now you young ones not going to know what I'm talking about, I ordered a Carling's Ale. That's green death in a bottle. You don't get drunk on it. You see, you get like a zombie and you walk around like... And I loved it. I drank it by the case. And when I ordered it, Isaac says, you know, Millie, I think I'll have one. And I said, why not? You've been going to this outfit for 3 months. Certainly they've taught you something. Drink one or two and leave it alone. Well, 23 days later, that was my longest and my hardest drunk. And I pray to God my last drunk. And I know this man loved me. He proved it to me for some 39 years. And someone had told us, and we did it very often, if you plan to drink, and I'm sure somebody in this room is going to drink again, it works. If you let beer get flat and drink it flat the next morning, it won't bounce. So we had 2 bottles of flat beer, and we were just as flat as a beer. In every department in our lives, mentally, physically, spiritually, financially, every way. And he said the hardest thing I think he ever had to say in his life. He said, "Millie, I can't live this way anymore." He said, "I don't care what you do." He said, "I'm going to give you what money we have in the bank, and you go back to Washington." He said, "Because I'm going back to Alcoholics Anonymous." Now, if you love somebody and you're on the verge of missing them, you'll know what I'm talking about. My stomach got like a knot. I didn't want to lose this man. He was the only thing on this earth that I loved. And see, Isaac was the kind of person, if I didn't give him a chance to think, I could con him into most everything. But I was in trouble if I gave him a few minutes to think it over. And I said, "Well, you go to your meeting, Isaac. We'll meet for dinner. And then you go to your meeting, and I'll go to the theater, and we'll talk about it." Well, he went on to his meeting after dinner, and I went to the theater, and I'd only been in there a short time. You see, this man's a mighty smart man. Never one time did he ever say, "Millie, you've got a drinking problem," because he knew what I'd tell him. So he never said this, but he came in and knelt down beside me in the theater, and he said, "Millie, they're having a Christmas party. And I'd give anything if you'd go with me. All the boys have their wives there." And I thought, well, certainly I can make this sacrifice if it's going to save my marriage. Now I'm going to tell you what I look like. Well, I thought I looked different. But anyhow, I'm going to tell you what a ride today. Hey, I'm sure right now you're thinking very sophisticated, a businesslike lady. Well, I had flaming red hair. You see, a friend and I don't hear this randee much anymore. We used to call it splitting a pint. We never said we were going to go in there and get a drink. We'd just say, "Let's split a pint." So this friend of mine, she's an alcoholic too, and ran a beauty salon, and we were splitting a pint, a couple of them. And she looked at me and she said, "You know, Millie, you'd make a hell of a redhead." I said, "Well, good, do it." Well, I woke up the next morning as a strawberry blonde. It was beautiful. But she was so drunk she forgot the formula. See, it didn't all come in bottles like it does today. So she couldn't get it back the same color, so she finally got it to a red, an auburn, and I wore it for many years. And I'm only 5'4", and as I say, I weighed 230 pounds. I had my hair piled real high on top of my head. See, that would make me look long instead of wide. I see they're coming back in style now. I wore an ankle bracelet, and only ladies of the street wore ankle bracelets back then. I had a cigarette holder about this long. Now, just for a moment, think about it. I had on a black satin dress. Can you imagine black satin wrapped around all that? I had a rhinestone pin this big, and it was right here. I thought I was the sexiest thing ever come down the pipe. And one of the Allenines told me later, said she turned to one of the others, and she said, "My God, that looks like a train coming into the station." But I thought I looked pretty good. Well, you see, this pride of mine got in my way. I attended the meeting. He said they were having a Christmas party. They did have a Christmas party after the meeting, but I stayed for the meeting. And they had a little lady that was much shorter than I, Ada, who later became my sponsor. And Ada got up and talked. And Ada was from a very fine family up in New York. But she was typical alcoholic, wound up on the Bowery. She had a rough go of it. And I sat there and listened to her, and I thought, "Old gal, you keep drinking. That's exactly where you're headed." But I didn't come to AA. See, I had too much pride. I didn't want anybody to know about my problems. So I started going to AA as a non-alcoholic, supporting my husband in his sobriety. Now, that's a route to go. I wouldn't get around the alcoholics because I knew you'd tell a story, I'd top it with one of mine. I'll do that even today. You sit around and listen to us. And I stayed with the 9 alcoholics. They didn't have Al-Anon then. I stayed with the 9 alcoholics. And I did the things that were wrong then, and they're wrong today. Now, I'm not preaching. I told somebody, and it's true, I hear a lot of preaching and teaching, but I don't hear a lot of sharing and caring anymore. But anyhow, I sat around with these women and told lies. I gossiped. I criticized. And gossip, even if it's true, it's vicious. I have seen gossip and criticism run an alcoholic out in the street again, to drink again, to die. And I've buried many of them. So if you've got a juicy piece of gossip, don't make it the gossip of your group. Go to that person and straighten it out with them. We're not playing a game of cards. We're dealing with lives. And you remember this. I try to remember it all the time. Isaac and I were privileged to go to Natural Bridge. If you've never been there, that's not a man-made bridge. It was put there by nature. And we attended the pageant the evening before, and we were sitting there in total darkness. And I had intelligence enough to know that it was a record and the voice was coming from the record. But this booming voice said, he said there will be light. And there was light thrown in every direction on this mammoth creation of God. And for the first time in my adult life, I cried. I had learned many years before this that a crying woman never gets a free drink. And I dried up my tears. But that night, I let them drip from my chin. Now, I'm not telling you that I had a spiritual awakening or experience as Bill did. It was not that sort of thing at all. All I can tell you is for the first time in my adult life, I felt clean inside and out. And on going back to the cabin, I said to Isaac, I'm going back to Alcoholics Anonymous and admit that I'm an alcoholic, or I'm going to get drunk. And the only thing Isaac said was, thank God. You see, this man had been praying for this. Well, I came back to the group, and when I walked in the closed meeting, everybody like dropped dead, and I had the first step and the third step and immediately jumped to the 12th step. Now, I had a big book, and I kept it on my coffee table, and I dusted it so you'd know it was there, but I hadn't read it. I had those three steps, and I went out to sober up the world. Now, I'm sure you've not done this. I went in bars and tried to drag people off bar stools. Didn't want to get off bar stools. In my own family, I tried to sober up a cousin. I was thrown out of his house. I was thrown out of a lot of houses I had not been invited in. I learned the hard way. And then I began to listen. And one of our members got up one night and talked about a personal inventory and how he did it. And my ears perked right up. And I listened to every word that George had to say. And I still feel that I owed so much to him because he opened up my life. And he died in alcoholic convulsions in the Portsmouth jail. But he left a message to many, and I'll always be grateful to him. And I began to do what AA told me to do, or was teaching me to do. I may sound like I'm doing a little preaching now, but there are things that bother me, and I want to share them with you. I hear them sitting around the table. My group, I can get by with it. I don't dare do it in the visiting group, but I can do it in my own group. They'll get talking about feelings. Got this kind of feeling and that kind of feeling. I said, look, you haven't got a damn thing but a lot of character defects. Get them straightened out, you won't have those feelings. And that's what the big book tells you, right? And this is what I did. I tried to straighten out my life. I'm still doing it. Women, I'm very, very sensitive where the alcoholic woman's concerned. One of you boys make a pass at one of my babies, you're going to be in trouble. I'll tell you. I'll say this, and it may shock a few, but you can't get sober through the zipper in your pants. And I started where with Ada taught me to love women. I didn't like women. I think I felt inadequate around other women, but I didn't like women. But Ada taught me to love women. And I know how rough it is for a woman out there. You see, you boys can panhandle. They don't do much of it now, but I'm talking back when I came in AA. You can panhandle, and this is all right. You can work in a kitchen washing dishes. They never give a woman a job in a kitchen washing dishes. If she panhandles, you know what they pick her up for? On a moral charge. She's soliciting. She's not bumming money. She's soliciting. And as I told you, it's rough in jail for them. But I can tell you this through my own experience. You let a gal walk into Alcoholics Anonymous, sure she talks tough. She has to be tough to live out in that world, or she gets into a lot of trouble. You have to learn to say, look, I buy my own drinks, buzz off. I didn't say it that way back then. But you have to learn to get tough, to protect yourself. But you let a gal come in here, maybe she uses two in jail for them. But I can tell you this through my own experience. You let a gal walk into Alcoholics Anonymous, sure she talks tough. She has to be tough to live out in that world, or she gets into a lot of trouble. You have to learn to say, look, I buy my own drinks, buzz off. I didn't say it that way back then. But you have to learn to get tough, to protect yourself. But you let a gal come in here, maybe she uses too much makeup. Maybe her mouth is a little dirty. But if you give her enough love and understanding, she'll become a lady. And I'm not talking through my hat, because one of my closest friends in AA was a little gal that spent time in penitentiary, and she was a tough little gal. But I would back her morals against anybody in this room today. I can remember one time I was at this group in Virginia, and I spoke, and this man came over and he said, Millie, we got a new gal. He said, would you mind talking to her? And I said, Lord, I'd love to. And I said, what's the problem? And he said, well, the gals won't have anything to do with her in the group because she had to make money for her booze, and she did it on the street. And I said, what's that got to do with alcoholism? You get a drink any way you can, male or female. And I talked to her, and I told her, I said, now, honey, Alcoholics Anonymous is not people. You're coming here to save your life. The program is Alcoholics Anonymous. And you just stick it out and let their remarks go by. Let them roll off your shoulder. And we'll keep in touch with each other. Well, a few years later, she married a boy in the group, and they came to the Newport News area. I was in business at that time. And I had a baby in AA, Rooney. And, you know, I don't know what you call them pigeons up here, don't you? And we call them baby down there. But I'll tell you, they'll both do the same thing in your lap if you don't watch them. But I had this baby, and of course she had not, really, I have to be honest. She had never drank out, and she really didn't know a lot about the rough part of drinking. And I called Rooney, and I told her this girl was coming to Newport News. I said, now, Rooney, she's not going to be just an AA member as far as I'm concerned. I'm going to make a friend out of her. I'm going to have her in my home. I plan to have lunch with her. I plan to do all the things that I do with you. Now, you can do whatever you want to do. And, of course, she immediately said, well, whatever you do, Millie, I'll do. Well, we made a friend out of this girl. And she was a lovely girl when she left Newport News. And I lost track of her for about 5 years. She was on construction work, and he moved around a lot. And I was in Virginia again, and this nice-looking, gray-headed lady, beautiful head of white hair, well-dressed, came up to me and hugged and kissed me, and she said, you don't know who I am, do you, Millie? And I said, honey, I have to be honest, I really don't. She said, I'm Mary. I could have dropped my teeth. I couldn't believe it. And she said, "Something I've got to share with you." She said, "Do you know they have just made me the president of the garden club?" And just for a moment, I thought, "Oh boy, wouldn't I love to tell that bunch of women who their president was?" But there's some of the experiences you have. Of course, I had some bad experiences. We all do that did 12. You don't have to do it today. Thank God for this. You know, I hear a few people talk about rehab centers and maybe they don't do everything right. But thank God for them. Because you see, when I came in AA, we had nothing. Doctors wouldn't talk to us. We had no place to take them but in our homes. I've had them convulsing on me. I had one set my house on fire. And the funniest one, I had one make a pass at my eyes. He got mad at me because I laughed. I thought it was funny. And we didn't have it easy. There was no place you could take a woman. And it's only recently they've started taking women, believe it or not. And you see, I get griped because to me, when I walked in Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't a man or a woman. I was an alcoholic looking for help. And I think that's what we all are. I don't go to all women's groups or all men's groups or all gay groups. I go to an AA meeting, and they got a mixture of everything. I stay active in AA. I have to tell this. I'm living on a little island now. We had AA down there. We started a group down there just on during the tourist season on Saturday night. And then when Isaac and I moved down there permanently, we kept it open year-round, and then we started another meeting on Tuesday. And all my friends that would come down and say, "Millie, how can we find you? We can't find you in the phone book." Alcoholics Anonymous, the phone book. So we had a business meeting, and I said, "Look, I worked for the telephone company when I retired." And I knew that if you had a business phone, I mean you had a private line, you could convert it to a business phone and put an additional listing on it. And I brought this up at the group. I said, "Anybody's got a private line can make Alcoholics Anonymous the main listing," which wound up with me. I didn't mean it to be that way, but that's what happened. But anyhow, and then a list, Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, they hummed and hawed. Nobody said anything. And I didn't want to go in there and push my weight around, you know, like I'm the boss. So I waited another 6 months, had another business meeting, came up again, and I got a temper, still have a temper. I work on it all the time. And I said, "Look, this is ridiculous." I said, "I'll take it for a year. And then we can alternate the thing." "Oh, yeah, yeah, well, everybody agreed to this." I'm going into my 17th year. Nobody wants it. But they don't know what they're missing. I get to talk to a lot of drunks on that phone. And everybody that comes through our area always calls, stops by. I'll tell all of you right now, don't come to my house before 11 o'clock. Give me a chance to do my dishes. But after that, until any time you want to stay, the 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning is all right with me. My back door's open all the time. I keep a coffee pot on all the time. Come home one day when Isaac was living. There's a note, dropped by, made a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, had a glass of milk, and read Isaac's Playboy, "See you later." And that's the kind of home I have. I have an AA home, and I'm grateful for this. I get griped. You know, we're so quick to say alcoholism is a disease, it's an illness. Yet we can't accept relapses, and I don't understand this. Certainly some of our boys and gals have relapses, and they drink again. And when they come back through that door, I hear remarks like, "Well, you think you're going to make it this time? You think you really want to do it?" That isn't what an alcoholic's looking for. They're looking for love and understanding. What I was looking for when I came into this organization. And I know my job. My job is to be there with my heart and my arms open and say, "Welcome home. Somewhere along the way, baby, you missed the boat. This time we'll try to do it together." And I think this is my responsibility for the rest of my life. I had been in AA just a short time. There were no women, as I told you. When I came into AA, we had a few around, but they weren't staying sober. I was the only one staying sober. So consequently, any time they had anything going on, Millie had to take part, because I was the only woman. They had plenty of boys, but they have a woman's outlook. Well, anyhow, they had a little program on the radio, Norfolk Speaks, and they asked Alcoholics Anonymous to put on an 8-minute, George, you'll get a kick out of this. We had an 8-minute show we rehearsed for a month. But my mother knew I was going to be on this program, and she had the radio on, and my dad was in the sitting room, and he said to her, "May, turn that radio up." Now, Mother said she turned it up. She didn't know what he was going to say. He listened to the whole program. And when it was over, he said to my mother, "May, tell Mildred to come home." That was my first AA dividend. I had 13 wonderful years with my dad. He didn't always understand me. I know one of the boys in AA asked him one time, "What did he think of AA?" He said, "Don't know much about it, but it sure made a lady of my daughter." But we had 13 wonderful years. I lost my mother after 7 years of sobriety. I said that was my first, and that's not true. It was the other one. When my mother died, she had several pieces of jewelry, and we knew where all the jewelry was going except this ring. I don't have any idea what the value of this ring is and don't care. It's worth $1 million to me. And Dad called me, and I went over, and he said, "You know, Mildred, out of all the girls, for the past 7 years, you've given your mother more love than any of the rest. And I feel like she would like for you to have this ring." Now, that may not mean much to you, but I was the black sheep of the family. I still got a sister today won't speak to me. I mean, that was a miracle, a real miracle. And then I had the 13 years with my dad that I'll always be grateful to. And you are the people that taught me all this. You see, I listened. That's the secret to this program. Take the cotton out of your ears and stick it in your mouth and listen. Now, down in our area, I find they're doing it in a lot of places. I'm just not going to let them do it in my area. We have a discussion meeting, but we have a speaker's meeting also. And one of the boys suggested we change it into a discussion. I said, "Look, the only reason you like discussion is because you can open your big mouth. At a speaker's meeting, you got to sit and listen. That's why you don't like a speaker's meeting. And you learn a lot by listening to speakers. And we've got young ones coming behind us that have got to learn to do what I'm doing right now. And where are they going to learn except in their own home group? I pray to God that you younger ones will carry this thing on after we're gone. Because I think about it so often, you will not believe that I have 12-stepped 3 generations in one family. The grandfather, the father, and the son. So you've got grandchildren, you've got children coming along. Where are they going when they're in trouble if we don't keep this thing alive? I don't think it's going to fold as long as we've got some that I know that are in AA. It's going to keep on going. But I know as long as I live, I've got a responsibility to Alcoholics Anonymous. And see, I enjoy AA. I don't go because I have to go. I go because I want to go. And I enjoy it. I was telling George, I said, "You know, I've got arthritis. And they're all helping me here and help me there." I said, "You know, George, I really don't hurt that bad, but I love the attention I get." But AA is my life. And it's taught me how to live. Now, I don't expect you young ones to live like I live. See, material things aren't important to me anymore. The older you get, the less you want. I know young people have to have Cadillacs and diamonds and gold and all this stuff. And this, I can understand this. Get it while you're young. Because when you get old, you're not going to do it. And I'll share this. This is what my program's all about for me. I don't make any big deal about it. I don't analyze it. I utilize it. When I get up in the morning, I've got a large picture window. It looks out across the sand dunes. And I have a large chair that I sit in. I get my coffee, and I sit there and say my prayers every morning. See, I don't understand these people that say, well, you know, I forgot to say my prayer at 12 o'clock. You see, this is part of my life. So it's a habit with me, maybe. But I say, dear God, thank you for another day of living. See, at my age, you do that. Thank you, dear God, for another day of sobriety. Because, you see, I've got faith enough in the God of my understanding that he's not going to put anything in my way today that he and I can't handle. And I believe this. So I thank him for my sobriety in the morning. And then I pray for many of you. And then I ask him, dear God, and I'm not preaching now, and I don't want you to misunderstand what I'm saying, but I do believe in Christ. Dear God, please let me walk on this earth as you did. Let me walk in your shoes. Let me distribute the love and the understanding and the patience that you did. Let me walk Christ-like. And then I start my day. I sit there and I meditate. And people say they don't know what meditation is. I just sort of look around my living room. And a lot of you have been in my living room. My whole house is AA. I can look in my living room and see all of you. I've got little things that people have given me from all over. And I hang them everywhere. I can care less what other people think. And I look around my living room and realize how much love I have. How many people that love me. And certainly you proved it when I lost my Isaac. I knew you loved me, but I didn't know you loved me that much. They brought me through that thing beautifully. They would not let me feel sorry for myself, and I wanted to. But my Isaac was one of the smartest men that ever lived, I think. He sat me down. The doctor told him he had 4 to 5 years, but Isaac knew better. And Isaac said, Millie, when I'm gone, there are only two things I ask you to do. Stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous and don't sell our home for at least a year till you can make up your mind which way you want to go. And I thank God that he gave me this, made me make those promises, because the first year I lost him, I was going to California, I was going to Florida, I was in my mind everywhere. But I had to stay because I'd made this promise. Now I wouldn't give my home up for anything unless I have to. I enjoy my little home. It's a very comfortable little home. Never have I, since I've been sober, never have I been without a roof over my head, food in my icebox, and a buck in my pocket, sometimes only a buck. But I have never wanted for anything. He's given me all that I need and many things that I don't need. As I say, I have a full life. I don't know what the future holds for me, no more than you know what it holds for you. But I know if I wake up tomorrow morning as I did this morning, my cup will runneth over. I know what I am today is God's gift to me. And what I become is my gift to God. And I thank my God for Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.